we love our families. And, you know, this death did not just affect the Tosi family, but it affected us as a community as a whole.
The Polynesian community in Anchorage looks for answers after a police shooting. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, July 5th. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, an archaeology dig reveals ancient artifacts in the Matsu Valley.
It's kind of like a time capsule. You go through different layers of soil. Each layer is representative of different time period.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Crowley, providing tanker support, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CPDAlaska.com. Avtec is recruiting rural Alaskans for computer and network training with no cost tuition for qualified applicants. For more about the Village Internet Agent Program, call 1-800-478-5389. This message sponsored by Avtec, Alaska's Institute of Technology.
A 66-year-old runner is missing after the July 4th Mount Marathon race in Seward. The man, Michael LeMaitre of Anchorage, was last seen near the top of the 3,022-foot mountain 3 hours after the race start. Alaska Mountain Rescue Group is on the scene searching for the man, and the search coordination has been handed over to the Alaska State Troopers after local volunteers failed to find any sign of LeMaitre last night. Troopers spokesperson Megan Peters.
Unfortunately, weather is hampering our search efforts. There's a lot of rain and fog, and it's making visibility very poor. So we certainly have a lot of people out and trying to track down this gentleman.
Peters says Alaska Air National Guard power jumpers have been called in to assist in the search. A trooper helicopter and search and rescue dogs have been dispatched to the scene.
At this point, the entire east side of the mountain has been searched with hasty search teams. They are going to be going back over the east side, doing more detailed searches. While that's going on, the AMRG teams are going to be doing a search of the west and the south side. Now, those are the most treacherous areas on the mountain.
LeMaitre's family reported him missing Wednesday evening. Seward Chamber of Commerce Director Cindy Clock said earlier today that volunteer rescuers had not been able to locate LeMaitre on the city side of the mountain last night. Seward officials are not commenting and have directed media inquiries to the troopers. Troopers say it is known that LeMaitre had poor eyesight and may have been running without his glasses. A Wasilla shooting involving an Alaska State Trooper is at least the seventh shooting involving authorities around the state this year. Troopers say Albert Samoa Maifea sustained non-life-threatening injuries in the shooting Wednesday night after the 35-year-old Anchorage man ran a red light and sped on the park's highway, driving toward oncoming traffic while passing vehicles. Troopers say the officer shot Maifea after the driver stopped and tried to run away, brandishing a gun. No charges have been filed against Maifea. The trooper's name will be released 3 days after the shooting, according to department policy. Troopers have been involved in at least 3 officer-related shootings this year. Anchorage police have been involved in 2 fatal shootings and 1 injury shooting. The Polynesian community is leading a rally to raise awareness about recent shootings by Anchorage police officers. Protesters want the APD to adopt a policy of shooting to disarm rather than to kill, but the APD says that's not likely. KSKA's Daisha Eaton explains.
Polynesian community groups are calling on the Anchorage Police Department to reconsider their policy on shooting people. Miriama Almave is the executive director of the Polynesian Community Center. She says they're trying to get the APD to consider changing their policy from shoot to kill to shoot to disarm.
They have sent letters to Chief Meal and also the mayor, but there has not been any response. So this is our way of stepping up and wanting to be heard. You know, in this cause, we want to combine some efforts on trying to implement better protocols on shooting to disarm or shooting to kill.
June 9th, an Anchorage police officer shot and killed Shane Tosi, who was brandishing a stick in the Mountain View neighborhood, saying the stick was a deadly weapon. Almave says the shooting sent shockwaves through the community.
One thing about the Polynesian community is we have a unique sense of unity. So we love our families. And, you know, this death did not just affect the Tosse family, but it affected us as a community as a whole. So we, you know, are trying to raise awareness of wanting to combine efforts with the police department so that we can prevent, you know, we can put protocols in place so we can prevent this types of tragedies from occurring.
Lieutenant David Parker is a public information officer with the APD. He says the policy is to use deadly force against those that threaten officers or other citizens.
In both of these situations that we've had recently, the officers were not in control of the situation. It was the person with the weapon that was in control who was acting out. Had Mr. Tosse simply stopped and obeyed the orders of the officer who was then pointing a gun at him instead of proceeding towards him and trying to strike him with the stick, he would not have been shot.
APD officials say Chief Mark Mew is planning to meet with select members of the Anchorage Community Police Relations Task Force and some leaders of the Polynesian community Friday, including Almave. Representatives from Mayor Dan Sullivan's office say they also plan to attend the meeting and will be at the rally Saturday. No word on whether Chief Mew will attend. The rally is set for Saturday, July 7th at noon at the Far North Bicentennial Park near the Anchorage Police Department on Martin Luther King Avenue. It's open to the public. Anchorage police officers have shot 3 people this year, 2 fatally. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Over 50 Alaska teachers are among 10,000 delegates assembled in Washington, D.C. this week for the annual National Education Association Representative Assembly. The NEA is the union that represents teachers across the country. NEA Alaska President Barb Ann Gayak says the convention, which wraps up today, is used to decide on the organization's direction for the coming year, including endorsement of a candidate for U.S. president. And Gayak says President Obama has been good for teachers.
He has been very focused on making sure that money and the resources are available to put educators back to work, making sure that we are looking at rebuilding the economy and helping middle-class families get back on their feet. Making sure that education is a top domestic priority.
And Gayak says there is room for improvement, especially when it comes to No Child Left Behind, which is up for reauthorization. She says some changes are needed to make the law work better in Alaska.
We have a lot of concern about the mandates for so much testing. That's a big concern. A lot of the educators that work in our state are really worried about the amount of time they spend in preparing students to take tests rather than actually educating them.
The state of Alaska is asking for a waiver from No Child Left Behind. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a sweeping assessment of the Arctic ecosystem.
From single-celled organisms to blue whales, polar bears, anything, plants, insects, you name it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska, one story at a time.
About 100 village-based emergency firefighters deployed yesterday to work a wildfire in the lower 48. State Division of Forestry spokeswoman Maggie Rogers says the crews from the communities of Shagaluk, St. Michael, Koyuk, Selawik, and Scammon Bay are the second group sent out to fight fires in western states this month.
The first group of crews went to the Fontenelle Fire in Wyoming, and the second group of crews that departed Wednesday morning went to the Shingle Fire. It's in Utah. It's, as of July 4th, had burned approximately 8,200 acres.
The human-caused fire started July 1st and is burning about 8 miles east of Dot Creek Village, Utah. Rogers says the state did not have any additional orders for Alaska village-based emergency fire crews as of last night.
But we have received a significant number of orders for support overhead and other agency crews and personnel.
The Alaska Interagency Coordination Center reported over a dozen new lightning-started wildfires in northwest Alaska over the last 2 days. Most are in remote areas and being allowed to burn, but a few are being fought. Scientists are looking for answers about why this year's Chinook salmon returns are so low on so many rivers across the state. The answer is going to be hard to find because the fish spend longer than any other salmon species at sea. And the sea, especially the Bering Sea, is changing. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
Fish managers have known about the Chinook salmon problems on the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers for a while. A decline has been evident for about 15 years, and for the last 4 or 5 years has steepened. They just do not see enough fish coming back from their 3 or 4 years in the Bering Sea. It's going to take a lot of sampling to understand what might be happening to the Chinook. The Bering Sea Fishermen's Association has been trying to do that for 10 years with its Arctic Yukon Kuskokwim Sustainable Salmon Initiative. Executive Director Karen Gillis says it's a big ocean.
It's the information that you don't get from just counting the fish that are returning to those rivers. It's the marine work, it's the juvenile work, it's the ocean mortality and the escapement quality and bycatch. Those data are really just emerging.
The project got a $3.2 million infusion of funds this fiscal year due to a capital appropriation requested by Senator Lyman Hoffman. It'll be used to expand on surveys already being done. Researcher Wyatt Fournier with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association is just about to head out on the next at-sea survey, trying to find out what Chinook salmon eat as they grow large in the Bering Sea. For some time, his project director, Ed Farley, has been concentrating on what happens to the fish during the first year after they leave the rivers. For the first year or two, they remain in shallower waters, areas not used by the trawl fleet, which is looking for pollock. Farley says at that time, Chinook salmon primarily eat other fish.
This is their first year in the ocean, and the food that they're eating encompass capelin. So these are real small capelin, larval and juvenile capelin. They eat sand lance. They eat small herring. And in some of the years where it was warm, they were even eating these little age-zero pollock.
When they move into deeper water, Chinook salmon are vulnerable to getting swept up in trawl gear, and plenty of effort has gone into trying to minimize that bycatch, with some success. The fleet caught about 9,000 Chinook this year, quite a drop from earlier years of 70,000 and more. But on the Yukon River, the raw numbers show that the Chinook are in trouble.
The current trend of weak runs, which began in 2007 and has extended into 2011 and 12 now, have resulted from low recruit per spawner ratios. What this means is, in the absence of any fishing, the population is just barely able to replace itself, with each spawner producing, on average, one prodigy surviving to return to the river or the spawning grounds.
And the Kuskokwim River has the same problem.
It's worse for the Kuskokwim. That population is not even replacing itself in the absence of fishing.
The Chinook salmon drop seen in the past 5 years partly comes from poor brood years when those salmon were hatched in the Yukon. This year marks a third cycle for those fish. Some of this year's run was just late, held up by the lingering ice of the Bering Sea. Beyond that, answers are going to be hard to come by, though, because Ed Farley's work, sampling the fish after they left the rivers, did not get funded in 2008, a critical year for this year's fish. It turns out that if it were any other year, NOAA might be able to show a correlation between the health of the Chinook the year after they left the rivers, the juvenile to spawner ratio, and their return.
And of course, if we've got this really good relationship, then our survey could potentially be used to help predict what's going to come back to the Yukon, 3 and 4 years into the future. And unfortunately, 2008 is our missing year.
Farley says the 2009 juvenile per spawner ratio was up, indicating potentially some improvement next year, which would be a relief to all. It's been 12 years now that the Fish and Game Department has been cutting Chinook harvests on Bering Sea rivers. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
The Arctic is home to about 20,000 known species, and a team of scientists is working on documenting them for the Arctic Biodiversity Assessment. The assessment is being conducted by the Arctic Council with the goal of describing the current state of the Arctic ecosystem. The lead scientist for the assessment was in Barrow recently to see the Alaskan Arctic firsthand. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Hans Mieltofte is a Danish ornithologist who specializes in shorebirds. This wasn't his first trip to the Alaskan Arctic, but even though he had seen it before, he had a hard time containing his excitement.
We saw on this trip alone, on only 10 days, we saw 26 species of shorebirds. And to give you an idea of what that is, we have 11 species in all of Greenland. So we saw more in 10 days than exist in Greenland at all. It is so rich out here that to me it's almost unbelievable to see those densities of birds and the variety.
Mieltofte says the Alaskan Arctic is so rich partly because its tundra is some of the southernmost that exists, and it wasn't covered by glaciers as recently as other parts of the Arctic.
This area, Alaska and northeasternmost Siberia, was not glaciated during the last glaciation, which means that a lot of species survived the last glaciation, as opposite to Greenland, which was almost totally ice-covered. And that, of course, has made a difference.
The Arctic Biodiversity Assessment is due out next year, and Mieltofte has the huge job of editing it. The document will probably come in at around 800 pages.
The Arctic Biodiversity Assessment is a kind of total review of all Arctic biodiversity, from single-celled organisms to blue whales, polar bears, anything, plants, insects, invertebrates in the sea, you name it.
The assessment is a desk study, so Mieltofte says it won't be uncovering any new Arctic species. And he says one of the conclusions of the assessment is that the Arctic is one of the least understood areas on the planet.
Of course, we know all the mammals, we know all the birds, but as soon as you go to invertebrates, to insects, to spiders, there are lots of unknown species. Each time you make a sample, you find new species.
Those holes in Arctic knowledge won't be filled immediately, but Mieltofte says he hopes the biodiversity assessment will serve as a baseline document. From there, he expects researchers will use the assessment as a starting point for filling in some of the gaps. He says he was encouraged by the number of international scientists he met on his trip to Alaska working to understand Arctic species. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. The Rasmussen Foundation sabbatical program offers nonprofit executives and tribal leaders paid time away from their jobs for personal renewal and growth, and organizations often become stronger as a result. October 1st is the deadline to apply. Learn more at rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
Somewhere north of what is now Trapper Creek, an ancient hunting party paused for a time. That was about 8,000 years ago, according to carbon dating on some of the artifacts found at the site. The dig has yielded rudimentary stone tools, but little information about the mysterious people who stopped there, whoever they were. They sure knew how to pick a spot, high ground looking down on a canopy of dense birch and fir, and beyond that, a view of the mountains. Recently, we tagged along to the dig site with Fran Seeger-Boss, the Matanuska Susitna Borough's Cultural Resources Director. She says thousands of years ago, there were no trees.
The environment would have been quite different, say 10,000 years ago or even 8,000 years ago. After the recession of the glaciers, I think it's just human nature to explore new regions, and this was a new region that was opening up south of the Alaska Range. And also because fauna and flora were moving into this area, it was only natural to follow the flow of animals and vegetation.
But now it's a sunny 70-degree day and would be buggy too, except for the breeze that blows the mosquitoes and no-see-ems away. This year, New York's Adelphi University is partnering in the dig. That gives archaeology students a crack at hands-on work. Four pits, called units, are carefully measured 1 meter by 1 meter on the knoll. Brian Weigel, An Adelphi assistant archaeology professor says the pits hold clues to ancient peoples.
We don't know who they were. We know them only by their stone tools. And so from their technology, we call them the Denali complex of people. And what we speculate is that they originated from north of the Alaska Range, probably the Nenana Valley, perhaps the Tananaw Valley, somewhere north in the foothills of the Central Alaska Range, and gradually over time moved through the Central Alaska Range and came into this valley. And we're trying to understand if they did that seasonally or if they moved down in one migration and occupied this region then year-round.
The crew has been here about a week, meticulously scraping dirt down, literally about a half 16th of an inch at a time. It's slow, painstaking work. They use small hand trowels, scraping the sides and bottoms of the units, looking for stones, flakes, anything that could be identified as a tool or a clue to what went on here all those years ago. Today, they are about 3 feet down. Varied colored layers of dirt define the passage of time on the sides of the pits. The charcoal-colored layer is the remains of a fire, a cooking fire perhaps?
As you can see here, that dark, that's a really nice sealed hearth inside that excavation unit. We would make sure not to handle it at all with our fingers and possibly put it into tin foil right away and handle it that way so that we don't get the residue from our hands on it.
Seeger Boss says no human or animal bone fragments have come to light. The soil here is so acidic that it would have eaten away at any of those long ago. The location of objects discovered in the dirt are mapped with meticulous precision using surveyor's tools.
East 34, below datum 84, below surface 74.
Then photographed and noted in the day's log. Students sweep the dirt from the units by tiny bits into plastic dust pans. Then it's dumped in 5-gallon buckets and carried by the bucket load to a homemade sifter. Student Vince Payne shakes the dirt through 1/8-inch mesh screening.
We are sifting through all the sediment we dig out to make sure we aren't missing anything that's culturally relevant that was shaped by human hands.
And the dig is yielding plenty of artifacts. Student Rob Michaels uncovers a flat, perfectly triangular stone. It is uniformly shaped along each side.
It's a piece of worked stone, possibly something that was used. Could be a tool, could not be, but it's definitely a little weird to find, you know, in a bunch of rocks.
So just dig around that big rock, Rob.
Professor Brian Weigel takes a look at the stone.
And what we can see from here is the point of impact from what would have been their hammer stone on the top here. That's one attribute that suggests that people modified this stone. The other thing is that it leaves flake scars or the remnants of other flakes that were knocked off of this piece.
The triangle was unearthed from a unit that has a long, heavy rock lying at the bottom. Rob Michaels has been scraping to reveal the big rock all day.
Well, right now it looks like it might be an anvil of some kind, which they would have made stone tools on or out of. So we're going to wait till we pull it out, and then we'll take it to the lab and see if we can find any tool marks on it. It's way bigger than a lot of the other stuff we've been pulling out of here.
Another find emerges from his effort, a hand-sized rock, heavy and flat at the top. It tapers down to a thin, semicircular shape. Could it be the prototype of the Alaska women's knife, the ulu? Further study will determine that. Seeger Boss says the dig will continue until they've taken all they can find.
When we find sterile soils and basic gravels and we know that there's probably no more human occupation past that point, that's where we stop.
Over the past 8 years, quite a collection of artifacts has emerged from the site. The stone tools are cleaned, cataloged, and studied for years. The artifacts belong to the Matanuska Susitna Borough, which eventually will place them with the University of Alaska Fairbanks Museum of the North. Future Alaskans can see them and wonder about their place in the scheme of time. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Alaska Territorial Guard members have not gotten the recognition that many local historians and veterans believe they deserve. The ATG was a World War II military reserve force, also known as the Eskimo Scouts. As KYUK's Mark Earhart reports, they are finally getting some local recognition in the form of an ATG Memorial Park in Bethel.
No excuse. I'm too old to be in the military.
Absolutely nothing between Japan and Anchorage except a bunch of Eskimos out there with a 30-06.
And setting up pieces of driftwood to look like soldiers and sticks to look like guns, so it sort of showed the presence of troops in this area.
Fritz Grenfeld has spent a lot of time thinking of the men and women of the Alaska Territorial Guard.
And now we take you direct to Washington, the nation's capital. The United States has been attacked by...
The ATG is often forgotten in discussion of the Second World War. On that fateful day in 1941, Japan's strike on Pearl Harbor showed America's vulnerability. And the Alaskan wilderness was our country's back door.
And the battleship West Virginia was reported sunk. Also, the battleship Oklahoma has been set on fire.
Grenfeld is one of several members of Bethel's ATG Memorial Planning Group. They have a list of over 6,300 names of men and women who served in the Guard.
70 years since these men and women performed their duty for our country, and it's time to get and recognize them and show our respect to them and their families for the service they provided to our country in our time of need.
When America went to war against Japan on December 8, 1941, nowhere was its vulnerability more apparent than in the territory of Alaska.
Grenfeld and the other members of the group have worked to get an ATG Memorial Park in Bethel, a feat that includes gardens and a gleaming metal statue of a Guard member holding a rifle. But he says they aren't satisfied with just the park.
Our next project is to work on getting the discharges for the family members.
He says many who were in the ATG never received an official discharge, a recognition other soldiers in the lower 48 received after their service.
Getting recognized sooner or later is better than not at all.
Grenfeld says that many men and women from the YK Delta area were involved in defending America's 49th state.
The total of the ATG members in this area is somewhere around 1,250 to 1,300 men and women.
The music, interviews, and news reports playing in the background of this story are from KYUK's 1995 documentary about the ATG, Uncle Sam's Men. I'm Mark Earhart.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Dacia Eaton and Steve Heimel in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Mark Earhart in Bethel. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Doyon Limited, celebrating 40 years as Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Home, it's where you lay your head, eat home-cooked meals, and gather with friends. Home is where you grew up and learned about life. Alaska is home, and when you choose to violate someone by committing sexual assault, you harm them, and you harm yourself, your friends, your family, your home, and Alaska. No one deserves to be sexually assaulted, so make the right choice. Real Alaskans choose respect. This message brought to you by the Alaska Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.